Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. On today's program, we have something pretty cool. Jose Munoz sent in a fiction story about a bike ride gone strange. We have two ghost stories from you guys.
No way.
And Tom tells us about weekends and old cars. I'm also very excited to tell you that we have the conclusion to our story, Second Variety. And it all begins with this 5-minute mystery.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by Newfangled Contraptions and is called A Pattern of Guilt. Both play a role in the story and therefore share the glory. Pay attention to the tale, and you too can share the air. Really bad poetry.
It is late afternoon in a small seaboard town, and in an old-fashioned house, old Doc Pucker is resting in his office, waiting for his housekeeper to bring him a cup of his beloved black coffee.
Doc Pucker, if you don't quit using that new operating table for a couch... You knew how it scares a body to walk in here and see you stretched out there.
Better than a couch, Carrie. It's adjustable. Long as I was foolish enough to buy this contraption, I might as well...
I'll get a doctor.
Is there a doctor here? I saw the sign. My friend, we were humming and the gun went off.
Good heavens, bring him right in. Doctor!
I'm here, Carrie. Here, young fella, put him right down here.
How is he, doctor?
A shotgun can make an awful mess of a man. Doesn't seem to be any... buckshot in him, except right here where it almost tore a hole through his chest.
But how is he?
Well, I'm afraid there's not much we can do for you, friend, young fella. He's dead. Feel better now? Sort of keeled over. What's this all about?
My name is Johnson. Bertrand Johnson. His name is Billings. We were partners in business.
I see. I'll have to know what happened for my report.
Well, as I... said, we were out hunting near here. That is, he was. Golf is my game. And today, he taught me how to aim and fire a shotgun.
This accident, if you could maybe tell me just how it happened.
Well, as I told you, he'd been showing me how to aim the gun, and then some birds flew out of the bushes up ahead of us, and he told me to go after them.
You only had this one gun between you?
Yes, Billings owned it.
So you went after the birds?
Every time I got near them, they flew away. I kept following them. I guess I must have lost track of direction. I saw something move in a bush and shot at it. It was Billings.
How could you make a mistake like that?
I don't know. But the bush was very thick and it was so far away.
Far away?
Well, it must have been at least 50 yards.
Excuse me. Carrie, can you come in here a minute?
Yes, doctor.
Here, Carrie, I want you to make a phone call. Number is on this slip of paper.
I'll leave my name and address, doctor. And the name of my partner's wife. If you could telephone her before I attempt to break the news.
It won't be necessary. Your name and address, I mean.
I don't understand.
That was the sheriff I asked Carrie to get on the phone. Until he gets here, I'm holding you for murder.
What makes the doctor suspect that what appears to be a typical hunting accident is deliberate murder? Do you know the clue? We'll learn in a moment. But first...
Well, for me, this one is pretty cut and dried. If you have ever fired a shotgun, you know two things. The first is that your arm hurts directly after firing it off. The second is that if you're using buckshot, you never aim, you just shoot. So, let's head back to the story and see what I mean.
Now, back to our story.
Doctor, you've no right to accuse me like this.
A little while ago, young fella, you were asking me how bad your friend was hurt, as if you didn't know. Then you told me Billings was behind a bush about 50 yards away when this accident happened. Anybody who knows about shotguns knows that the farther away the target is, the more the pattern of buckshot spreads out. The pattern of buckshot in Billings' body proves that it was no accident, that you couldn't have been more than a few feet from him when you pulled the trigger. No, my friend, your alibi missed its mark.
While we have no motive, other than he was a business partner, and in these stories, partners always kill each other, we do know that shotguns loaded with buckshot are not all that lethal unless at close range. I, for one, think the doc has this guy dead to rights. So to speak. Well, I don't have much to say today. We've received a fifth UFO story this week for the upcoming special podcast. This one came from Margarito Bernal in Colorado. I had a wonderful time talking with Margarito on the phone this past week. He has an experience I can't wait to share with you. I do believe that we have enough stories now, and I have sent out 3 emails to ufologists in hopes of getting one of them to come on the show. I'm not sure what I'm going to do if all 3 agree. That could be a problem. 3 UFO shows? Who knows? I received this email from Jackson MI this past week. Hello, Ron. Thank you for the podcast and the stories. I wanted you to know that I am a long-haul trucker, and listening to podcasts is my life. Not only do they make the time pass, but they have so much good information to pass along. What I like about your show are the facts you throw in about what we are hearing. I think that's what makes your podcast so special. Don't ever stop. By the way, I have listened to all 370-plus podcasts, even the archived ones. Jackson. Well, Jackson, I want to thank you for the kind note. I think it's amazing that you've listened to all of them. The first 50 or so are not all that great, in my opinion. Please be safe on the road, and thank you for taking me with you. That's pretty cool. And now, this message from Gladys Goodies.
I'm Gladys, the dachshund, the face of Gladys Goodies. Are you worried about your pet's health? My parents were too, especially since I developed pancreatitis. They couldn't find any treats I could eat, so they made some. Our natural treats are healthy for all dogs, with and without health issues. We have lots of delicious flavors like chicken, turkey, salmon, sweet potato, beef, and more. With our homemade treats, you won't worry about the contents because they have no chemicals, fillers, or bad ingredients. Go to GladysGoodies.com now to get your fur friend a bag. And pick them up some swag while you're there. You'll be glad you did. Remember, we have the treats and swag to make their tails wag. Again, that's GladysGoodies.com. Again, that's GladysGoodies.com.
Thank you, Gladys. And don't you forget to use our very own promo code, RONS. That's RONS. Use it, and you'll get a 20% discount on anything you buy at Gladys Goodies. Thank you, Gladys. And now, here are your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
This story comes from Tyson Bradley in Tampa, Florida, which, for the record, is where this podcast is broadcast from, over the radio. How about that? Hello, Ron. I live and work in South Korea, but my home is in Tampa. I recently heard this when I was in a restaurant in Changwon. One day, a girl was walking home late night after work. It was dark and around midnight. She lived in an apartment where they had an elevator. She got in the elevator, and when the door was about to close, a strange man with a red hoodie entered the elevator. He apologized for scaring her and asked which floor she was heading to. Without making eye contact, she told him. The man casually pressed the button and went below. As they were on their way, he asked to use her cell phone. She declined and isolated herself in the corner. After a few seconds of silence, the elevator arrived on the floor below the one the girl was heading to, and the door opened. The guy slowly walked out of the door and turned around, facing towards the elevator and the girl. He just stared at her without any movement. Slowly, the door started to close, and from the gap, she could see him turning around, heading for the upstairs, pulling a knife out of his pocket. When she arrived on her floor, she saw the man coming to her at a fast pace. She screamed and closed her eyes. After several seconds, nothing happened. The girl looked up, and there was no one there. Tyson Bradley, Tampa, Florida. Well, Tyson, that is a scary story. It makes one wonder about getting in elevators late at night. This next story comes from Melody Hanks from Brighton, Texas. This is Melody's second story to us. Just to remind you, Melody is a sensitive and says she has a lot of stories to share. Here is her email. Hello, Ron. I still love your show and still never miss an episode. This story is quite recent. My grandfather passed away and told me that he would come see me so that I could know that everything was okay. 2 days after he died, the neighborhood security guard knocked on our door on a Sunday morning. He told us, "An old man came to your house earlier, knocked on your door for half an hour, and finally left. When I asked him what he wanted, he told me he needed to say goodbye to someone and that he was okay." We were all stunned. We had no idea who this old man was or who he was looking for. The guard stopped talking and pointed to a picture of my grandfather hanging on the wall. "That's the old man." My entire family froze for a minute. I'm not 100% sure if the guard was telling the truth, but I also have no reason not to believe him. I really like the idea of my granddad coming by to say goodbye and keep his promise. Melody Hanks, Brighton, Texas. That was another great story, Melody. Thank you for sharing it. Oh, and I don't see any reason not to believe it. So, are you ready for the final installment of Second Variety? Second Variety is a classic science fiction tale written by Philip K. Dick. It was suggested to us by listener Mark Lopez. It was first published in Space Science Fiction in the May of 1953 issue. In parts 1 through 3, we learn that the Americans have created self-replicating robots to fight the Russians for them. Also, that these robots have flipped the script and began making humanoid versions of themselves to fool their enemies. The Russians took many losses and were forced to work with the Americans to end the war. However, we have now found out that these robots are the true devils and that they have taken over the American bunkers. Klaus turned out to be one of them, and Tasso killed him for it. But was he the second variety? And what will Major Hamilton and Russian Tasso do now? Let's find out in the final chapter of Second Variety.
Tasso did not answer. She glanced up at him, her eyes bright in the firelight. Hendricks examined his arm. He could not move his fingers. His whole side seemed numb. Down inside him was a dull, steady ache. How do you feel? Tasso asked. My arm is damaged. Anything else? Internal injuries. You didn't get down when the bomb went off. Hendricks said nothing. He watched Tasso pour the coffee from the cup into a flat metal pan. She brought it over to him. Thanks. He struggled up enough to drink. It was hard to swallow. His insides turned over and he pushed the pan away. That's all I can drink now. Tasso drank the rest. Time passed. The clouds of ash moved across the dark sky above them. Hendricks rested, his mind blank. After a while, he became aware that Tasso was standing over him, gazing down at him. What is it? He murmured. Do you feel any better? Some. You know, Major, if I hadn't dragged you away, they would have got you. You would be dead. Like Rudy. I know. Do you want to know why I brought you out? I could have left you. I could have left you there. Why did you bring me out? Because we have to get away from here. Tasso stirred the fire with a stick, peering calmly down into it. No human being can live here. When the reinforcements come, we won't have a chance. I have pondered about it while you were unconscious. We have perhaps 3 hours before they come. And you expect me to get us away? That's right. I expect you to get us out of here. Why me? Because I don't know any way. Her eyes shone at him in the half-light, bright and steady. If you can't get us out of here, they'll kill us within 3 hours. I see nothing else ahead. Well, Major, what are you going to do? I've been waiting all night. While you were unconscious, I sat here waiting and listening. It's almost dawn. The night is over. Hendricks considered. It's curious, he said at last. Curious? That you should think I can get us out of here. I wonder what you think I can do. Can you get us to the moon base? The moon base? How? There must be some way. Hendricks shook his head. No, there's no way that I know of. Tasso said nothing. For a moment, her steady gaze wavered. She ducked her head, turning abruptly away. She scrambled to her feet. More coffee? No. Suit yourself. Tasso drank silently. He could not see her face. He lay back against the ground, deep in thought, trying to concentrate. It was hard to think. His head still hurt. And the numbing daze still hung over him. There might be one way, he said suddenly. Oh? How soon is dawn? 2 hours. The sun will be coming up shortly. There's supposed to be a ship near here. I've never seen it, but I know it exists. What kind of a ship? Her voice was sharp. A rocket cruiser. Will it take us off? To the moon base? It's supposed to, in case of emergency. He rubbed his forehead. What's wrong? My head. It's hard to think. I can hardly concentrate. The bomb. Is the ship near here? Tasso slid over beside him, settling down on her haunches. How far is it? Where is it? I'm trying to think. Her fingers dug into his arm. Nearby? Her voice was like iron. Where would it be? Would they store it underground? Hidden underground? Yes. In a storage locker. How do we find it? Is it marked? Is there a code marker to identify it? Hendricks concentrated. No. No markings. No code symbol. What then? A sign. What sort of sign? Hendricks did not answer. In the flickering light, his eyes were glazed. Two sightless orbs. Tasso's fingers dug into his arm. What sort of sign? What is it? I can't think. Let me rest. All right. She let go and stood up. Hendricks lay back against the ground, his eyes closed. Tasso walked away from him, her hands in her pockets. She kicked a rock out of her way and stood staring up at the sky. The night blackness was already beginning to fade into gray. Morning was coming. Tasso gripped her pistol and walked around the fire in a circle back and forth. On the ground, Major Hendricks lay, his eyes closed, unmoving. The grayness rose in the sky higher and higher. The landscape became visible, fields of ash stretching out in all directions. Ash and ruins of buildings. A wall here and there, heaps of concrete, the naked trunk of a tree. The air was cold and sharp. Somewhere a long way off, a bird made a few bleak sounds. Hendricks stirred. He opened his eyes. "Is it dawn? Already?" "Yes." Hendricks sat up a little. "You wanted to know something. You were asking me." "Do you remember now?" "Yes." "What is it?" She tensed. "What?" she repeated sharply. "A well. A ruined well. It's in a storage locker under a well." "A well." Tasso relaxed. "Then we'll find a well." She looked at her watch. "We have about an hour, Major. Do you think we can find it in an hour?" "Give me a hand up," Hendricks said. Tasso put her pistol away and helped him to his feet. "This is going to be difficult." "Yes, it is." Hendricks set his lips tightly. "I don't think we're going to go very far." They began to walk. The early sun cast a little warmth down on them. The land was flat and barren, stretching out gray and lifeless as far as they could see. A few birds sailed silently far above them, circling slowly. "See anything?" Hendricks said. "Any claws?" "No, not yet." They passed through some ruins, upright concrete and bricks, a cement foundation. Rats scuttled away. Tasso jumped back warily. "This used to be a town," Hendricks said. "A village, a provincial village. This was all grape country once, where we are now." They came onto a ruined street, weeds and cracks crisscrossing it. Over to the right, a stone chimney stuck up. "Be careful," he warned her. A pit yawned, an open basement. Ragged ends of pipes jutted up, twisted and bent. They passed part of a house, a bathtub turned on its side, a broken chair, a few spoons and bits of china dishes. In the center of the street, the ground had sunk away. The depression was filled with weeds and debris and bones. "Over here," Hendricks murmured.
"This way?"
"To the right." They passed the remains of a heavy-duty tank. Hendricks's belt counter clicked ominously. The tank had been radiation-blasted. A few feet from the tank, a mummified body lay sprawled out, mouth open. Beyond the road was a flat field, stones and weeds and bits of broken glass. "There," Hendricks said. A stone well jutted up, sagging and broken. A few boards lay across it. Most of the well had sunk into rubble. Hendricks walked unsteadily toward it, Tasso beside him.
"Are you certain about this?"
Tasso said.
"This doesn't look like anything."
"I'm sure." Hendricks sat down at the edge of the well, his teeth locked. His breath came quickly. He wiped perspiration from his face. "This was arranged so the senior command officer could get away. If anything happened, if the bunker fell."
"That was you?"
"Yes."
"Where is the ship? Is it here?"
"We're standing on it." Hendricks ran his hands over the surface of the well stones.
"The eyelock responds to me, not to anybody else. It's my ship, or it was supposed to be."
There was a sharp click. Presently they heard a low, grating sound from below them.
"Step back," Hendricks said.
He and Tasso moved away from the well. A section of the ground slid back. A metal frame pushed slowly up through the ash, shoving bricks and weeds out of the way. The action ceased as the ship nosed into view. "There it is," Hendricks said. The ship was small. It rested quietly, suspended in its mesh frame like a blunt needle. A rain of ash sifted down into the dark cavity from which the ship had been raised. Hendricks made his way over to it. He mounted the mesh and unscrewed the hatch, pulling it back. Inside the ship, the control banks and the pressure seat were visible. Tasso came and stood beside him, gazing into the ship. "I'm not accustomed to rocket piloting," she said after a while. Hendricks glanced at her.
"I'll do the piloting." "Will you? There's only one seat, Major. I can see it's built to carry only a single person."
Hendricks's breathing changed. He studied the interior of the ship intently. Tasso was right. There was only one seat. The ship was built to carry only one person.
"I see," he said slowly. "And the one person is you." She nodded. "Of course."
"Why?"
"You can't go. You might not live through the trip. You're injured. You probably wouldn't get there."
"An interesting point. But you see, I know where the moon base is, and you don't. You might fly around for months and not find it. It's well hidden. Without knowing what to look for, I'll have to take my chances. Maybe I won't find it, not by myself, but I think you'll give me all the information I need. Your life depends on it."
"How?"
"If I find the moon base in time, perhaps I can get them to send a ship back to pick you up. If I find the base in time. If not, then you haven't a chance. I imagine there are supplies on the ship. They will last me long enough."
Hendricks moved quickly,
but his injured arm betrayed him. Tasso ducked, sliding lithely aside. Her hand came up lightning fast. Hendricks saw the gun butt coming. He tried to ward off the blow, but she was too fast. The metal butt struck against the side of his head, just above his ear. Numbing pain rushed through him. Pain and rolling clouds of blackness. He sank down, sliding to the ground. Dimly, he was aware that Tasso was standing over him, kicking him with her toe.
"Major, wake up."
He opened his eyes, groaning.
"Listen to me."
She bent down, the gun pointed at his face.
"I have to hurry. There isn't much time left. The ship is ready to go, but you must tell me the information I need before I leave."
Hendricks shook his head, trying to clear it.
"Hurry up. Where is the moon base? How do you find it? What do I look for?"
Hendricks said nothing.
"Answer me."
"Sorry."
"Major, the ship is loaded with provisions. I can coast for weeks. I'll find the base eventually, and in a half hour you'll be dead. Your only chance of survival..." She broke off.
Along the slope, by some crumbling ruins, something moved. Something in the ash. Tasso turned quickly, aiming. She fired. A puff of flame leaped. Something scuttled away, rolling across the ash. She fired again. The claw burst apart, wheels flying.
"See," Tasso said, "a scout. It won't be long."
"You'll bring them back here to get me?"
"Yes, as soon as possible."
Hendricks looked up at her. He studied her intently.
"You're telling the truth?"
A strange expression had come over his face, an avid hunger.
"You'll come back for me? You'll get me to the moon base?" "I'll get you to the moon base. But tell me where it is. There's only a little time left."
"All right." Hendricks picked up a piece of rock, pulling himself to a sitting position.
"Watch."
Hendricks began to scratch in the ash. Tasso stood by him, watching the motion of the rock. Hendricks was sketching a crude lunar map.
"This is the Apennine Range. Here is the crater of Archimedes.
The moon base is beyond the end of the Apennine, about 200 miles. I don't know exactly where. No one on Terra knows. But when you're over the Apennine, signal with one red flare and a green flare, followed by two red flares in quick succession. The base monitor will record your signal. The base is under the surface, of course. They'll guide you down with magnetic grapples. And the controls, can I operate them? The controls are virtually automatic. All you have to do is give the right signal at the right time. I will. The seat absorbs most of the takeoff shock. Air and temperature are automatically controlled. The ship will leave Terra and pass out into free space. It'll line itself up with the moon, falling into an orbit around it about 100 miles above the surface. The orbit will carry you over the base. When you're in the region of the Apennine, release the signal rockets. Tasso slid into the ship and lowered herself into the pressure seat. The arm locks folded automatically around her. She fingered the controls. "Too bad you're not going, Major. All this put here for you, and you can't make the trip." "Leave me the pistol." Tasso pulled the pistol from her belt. She held it in her hand, weighing it thoughtfully. "Don't go too far from this location. It'll be hard to find you as it is." "No. I'll stay here by the well." Tasso gripped the takeoff switch, running her fingers over the smooth metal. "A beautiful ship, Major. Well built. I admire your workmanship. You people have always done good work. You build fine things. Your work, your creations are your greatest achievement." "Give me the pistol," Hendricks said impatiently, holding out his hand. He struggled to his feet. "Goodbye, Major." Tasso tossed the pistol past Hendricks. The pistol clattered against the ground, bouncing and rolling away. Hendricks hurried after it. He bent down, snatching it up. The hatch of the ship clanged shut. The bolts fell into place. Hendricks made his way back. The inner door was being sealed. He raised the pistol unsteadily. There was a shattering roar. The ship burst up from its metal cage, fusing the mesh behind it. Hendricks cringed, pulling back. The ship shot up into the rolling clouds of ash, disappearing into the sky. Hendricks stood watching a long time, until even the streamer had dissipated. Nothing stirred. The morning air was chill and silent. He began to walk aimlessly back the way they had come. Better to keep moving around. It would be a long time before help came, if it came at all. He searched his pockets until he found a package of cigarettes. He lit one grimly. They had all wanted cigarettes from him, but cigarettes were scarce. A lizard slithered by him through the ash. He halted, rigid. The lizard disappeared. Above, the sun rose higher in the sky. Some flies landed on a flat rock to one side of him. Hendricks kicked at them with his foot. It was getting hot. Sweat trickled down his face into his collar. His mouth was dry. Presently, he stopped walking and sat down on some debris. He unfastened his medicine kit and swallowed a few narcotic capsules. He looked around him. Where was he? Something lay ahead, stretched out on the ground, silent and unmoving. Hendricks drew his gun quickly. It looked like a man. Then he remembered. It was the remains of Klaus, the second variety, where Tasso had blasted him. He could see wheels and relays and metal parts strewn around on the ash, glittering and sparkling in the sunlight. Hendricks got to his feet and walked over. He nudged the inert form with his foot, turning it over a little. He could see the metal hull, the aluminum ribs and struts. More wiring fell out, like viscera. Heaps of wiring, switches and relays, endless motors and rods. He bent down. The brain cage had been smashed by the fall. The artificial brain was visible. He gazed at it. A maze of circuits, miniature tubes, wires as fine as hair. He touched the brain cage. It swung aside. The type plate was visible. Hendricks studied the plate. And blanched. IV. Dash IV. For a long time, he stared at the plate. Fourth variety. Not the second. They had been wrong. There were more types, not just three. Many more, perhaps. At least four. And Klaus wasn't the second variety. But if Klaus wasn't the second variety... Suddenly he tensed. Something was coming, walking through the ash beyond the hill. What was it? He strained to see. Figures. Figures coming slowly along, making their way through the ash, coming toward him. Hendricks crouched quickly, raising his gun. Sweat dripped down into his eyes. He fought down rising panic as the figures neared. The first was a David. The David saw him and increased its pace. The others hurried behind it. A second David, a third. Three Davids, all alike, coming toward him silently, without expression, their thin legs rising and falling, clutching their teddy bears. He aimed and fired. The first two Davids dissolved into particles. The third came on, and the figure behind it, climbing silently toward him across the gray ash, a wounded soldier towering over the David, and behind the wounded soldier came two Tassos walking side by side. Heavy belt, Russian army pants, shirt, long hair. The familiar figure, as he had seen her only a little while before, sitting in the pressure seat of the ship. Two slim, silent figures, both identical. They were very near. The David bent down suddenly, dropping its teddy bear. The bear raced across the ground. Automatically, Hendricks's fingers tightened around the trigger. The bear was gone, dissolved into mist. The two Tasso types moved on, expressionless, walking side by side through the gray ash. When they were almost to him, Hendricks raised the pistol waist high and fired. The two Tassos dissolved, but already a new group was starting up the rise, five or six Tassos, all identical, a line of them coming rapidly toward him. And he had given her the ship and the signal code. Because of him, she was on her way to the moon, to the moon base. He had made it possible. He had been right about the bomb, after all. It had been designed with knowledge of the other types, the David type and the wounded soldier type, and the Klaus type. Not designed by human beings. It had been designed by one of the underground factories, apart from all human contact. The line of Tassos came up to him. Hendricks braced himself, watching them calmly. The familiar face, the belt, the heavy shirt... The bomb carefully in place. The bomb. As the Tassos reached for him, a last ironic thought drifted through Hendricks's mind. He felt a little better thinking of it. The bomb. Made by the second variety to destroy the other varieties. Made for that end alone. They were already beginning to design weapons to use against each other.
Did you see that end coming? I surely did not. This story is a classic and is atypical of 1950s science fiction, which was the trademark of its writer, Philip K. Dick. His stories never fit the mold, and it's why they play so well today. Much of his work, including Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep from 1968, went on to be major motion pictures. Now, you may not recognize that name, but perhaps you know it better as Blade Runner, starring Harrison Ford. We were quite lucky to get this story. 90% of Philip's novels and shorts are held under very restrictive copyrights. Why? Well, it's simply because they're just that good.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by amazing people.
This time on As Read By, we have a fictional story sent in by Jose Munoz of Fairfax, Virginia. It was sent in as part of the UFO podcast, but because it isn't a true story, I decided to play it this week instead. I have to say, it was completely written by Jose, and I didn't edit a thing. Very good job, and it's a great story. So here is Jose's story, which he has titled, An Encounter While Biking. It was a dark and stormy night. Well, truthfully, it wasn't. It just felt that any good story should begin with a line like that. Actually, it was a beautiful spring day. The sun was out. Temperature was in the low 80s, low humidity, birds were singing. Well, you get the picture. Because it was such a nice day, I thought I'd go on a 20-mile bike ride. I usually ride around 12 miles, but I felt really good today and figured I'd just go for it. I got my bike all set and was on the trail when I noticed that the birds had stopped their singing. In fact, there was no animal, insect sounds, or breeze of any kind. To make sure, I turned off my iPod and removed my headphones. Sure enough, dead silence. Now that's odd, but little did I realize, in a few short minutes, I would have taken odd over what happened to me next. As I said, I was biking, just pedaling away, enjoying my ride, when I noticed I wasn't moving. I was pedaling all right, but I wasn't moving. I could feel my legs going up and down. I could see the front wheel turning, but I wasn't going anywhere. It was as if I were biking on a treadmill. I did not move, not 1 yard, not 1 foot, not 1 inch. Then I noticed that the cars that were passing me on the road were looking in my direction with a surprised look on their face. One boy was trying to get his father's attention while pointing at me and yelling, "How are you doing that?" I sure wish I knew. I tried to stop pedaling, but found I could, which served only to increase my anxiety. How long could something like this go on? Cars that were passing me were slowing down, trying to get a better look. I guess. I'm not sure how long this went on, but after a while, I noticed that the sky was getting darker, and far off in the distance, I could see a silver-colored object. More than that, it was a disc-shaped silver-colored object. It was a UFO. An honest-to-goodness UFO just like what you see in the movies. The object moved, and moved very quickly and silently, from where I first saw it to just overhead within a matter of a fraction of a second. Or at least it seemed that way to me. It was maybe 30 feet above my head, and I'm still pedaling and still not going anywhere. I turned to look at the cars that were looking at me, but they were gone. Indeed, everything was gone. It was all pitch black, blacker than black. At this point, I was surrounded by a blue glow, and I could feel myself slowly being lifted up. Lifted up towards the UFO, or whatever it was. And then I found myself sitting outside of Starbucks that I usually go to at the halfway point of my 20-mile ride. How did I get there? I had no recollection of biking the rest of the way from where I was to the Starbucks. None whatsoever. Not only that, I was holding an iced coffee, so I must have ordered it. I looked at the time on my phone. It showed that it was 3 p.m. 3 hours from the time I left my house. A trip that typically would have taken me an hour at most took me 3 hours. Where was I all that time? How did I get here? There was a couple sitting next to me, so I decided to play detective and see if I could get to the bottom of this. I asked them, "Excuse me, do you know how long I've been here?" H gave me an odd look and replied almost in unison, "Don't you know?" They replied that they had no idea, that they had been sitting here quietly and didn't notice anyone at the table next to theirs until I had come over to their table. "Thanks," I said. So that was of no help. Sitting back down, I tried to recall everything I could. Biking, pedaling but not moving, the car staring at me, seeing a UFO, pitch black, and being lifted up toward the object. Yes, that's it. I must have been lifted into the object. But that's all I can remember. 3 hours gone. What happened while I was inside the object? How did I get to Starbucks? Why isn't this all over the news? I went to my phone and scanned the news items, and there was nothing about any aerial phenomenon having taken place. I examined myself as best I could to see if I had any evidence of being tampered with. No sore spots, no puncture wounds, no redness anywhere, and then flash. It was as if images had been downloaded right into my brain. Actually, it was a series of images of inside the UFO. Sleek and silvery walls that were covered with what appeared to be screens. The screens showed various pictures of Earth from high above. I could see instrument panels and various colored lights. I could hear sounds, but it was not possible to describe the sounds other than otherworldly. If there was an odor, it was that of sterile facility. But, however, I didn't see any UFO inhabitants. None. Zero. Nada. Zilch. Not a single entity. Why was I brought on board? By whom? Why me? What am I supposed to do with this information? Do I go to MUFON? If I do, what do I tell them? I have no proof. I can't say, "See what they did to me?" Other than missing 3 hours, I have nothing. Nothing other than this story to tell. And if I did tell my story, I'd only be labeled as some nut. But who would believe me anyway? Would you? It was just an encounter while biking. Next time, I'll just stay home and play video games. Jose Munoz, Fairfax, Virginia. What a great story, Jose. It all sounds so real. Thank you for sending this in. I know that I enjoyed it, and I'll bet the listeners did as well. When I asked Jose if there was any truth to this story, I got this response. The only truth to the story was that I do go biking, and every once in a while, I do go on a 20-mile trip and stop off at a Starbucks at the halfway point. I keep telling myself I should write a story, as it seems I always have ideas, and I keep saying someday. So, I thought I'd give it a shot. Jose. Well, you gave it better than a shot. This was well written and a very fun story to tell. Thank you again, Jose. To do it, or at least are trying to work on it. Some of us may never really accomplish it, and for others it is faded away too soon. Tom Williams, well, he's a lucky man. He lives in Berlin, Germany, was raised in Alabama, and sends in these tales from his youth. Well, Once more, Tom has come out of retirement to tell us another story that he calls
Weekends and Old Cars. As mentioned before, weekends were mostly for family visits, taking Fred back to the home, or working on the old car so that Dad could get to work on the next shift. My dad was always looking for old junk cars he could get and make a little money by taking them to the junkyard for scrap metal. I don't know how legal it was, but often I would be the kid at the wheel of the towed vehicle. No driver's license, naturally. Once we were able to get an old bread truck, might call a cube van, and Dad tied a very long tow rope to the junker, and we set out across town. Now this time my cousin Kermit was at the wheel. We didn't know that the towed truck had faulty brakes, so at the first stoplight and at a very high speed, Kermit couldn't manage to stop before hitting my dad's car. The only choice for Kermit was to go around Dad's car, which also, at the end of the rope, jerked Dad's car a little to the left, somewhat as we had passed. I'll never forget the look on Dad's face as he looked to the left and saw us there. Now, on the subject of old cars, today many historic car collectors would go into a fetal position and cry their eyes out if they knew that my dad had cut down a couple of old Model A Fords into trucks. As a child, I always dropped down into the back seat to hide because of the embarrassment of riding in an old jalopy. Whenever we were told that we were moving again, we almost dropped to our knees and prayed that the next old house would be at the top of a hill and not below. Why? Well, have you ever tried to push an Oldsmobile 88 with an automatic transmission up a hill to start it? Think about it for a minute. Fred reminded me the other day about us taking him back to the home on Sunday nights in one of Dad's old cars that had a bad muffler which he couldn't afford to repair or replace. Summers were no problem because we could roll the windows down. But those cold winter nights were killers. There was always a choice between rolling down the windows for air to breathe and freezing, or finding yourself dead on arrival due to carbon monoxide poisoning from the bad muffler. As you can hear, Fred and I are still alive and kicking because we chose to roll down the windows. That is, when the window crank worked. Here's to fresh air and old cars. Sincerely, Tom.
What a great story, Tom. It reminds me of my very first car. Actually, it was a truck. A 1971 Datsun pickup, pea green in color, and the envy of all my friends. One winter, my dad noticed that the back tires were in poor shape. He flat out told me that I would not drive it again until it had decent wheels. I was a high school kid, did have a job, but there was no way I could afford even a single new tire. After much negotiation, he bought the tires for me. Well, I kind of took advantage of things and bought the biggest and widest slicks on the market. My dad took one look at those tires I bought and let me know that I was the dumbest kid on the planet and there was no way that they would fit. I told him he was off and drove the truck and the new tires up to a service station to have them put on. The guy took one look at the tires, shook his head, and started laughing. Shamed, I took the tires back, bought reasonable tires for a reasonable price. Lesson learned. Thank you, Tom, for your story, and I do hope that we hear more from you again. You are the best. We're all done, don't you know? I want to thank Jackson M.I., Tyson Bradley, Melody Hanks, Mark Lopez, Jose Munoz, and Tom Williams for their contributions to the podcast this week. You guys truly are the best. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you will find every link you'll need. Do you want to help the show? Please leave reviews and feedback on whatever service you use to listen to us. This really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.